Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics, mostly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and it's a warm welcome to a new member of the book club, a friend that I met at Enniskillen this year. It's a big hello to Pete Trainer. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Eamon. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you very much for doing this. Now, we were introduced by our mutual friend, Giles Wright, member of the five-star club here on the book club, at Enniskillen this year, weren't we?
We were, and what a great weekend it was.
It was a splendid weekend, actually, yes. We did have a great time. We'll talk a little bit more about it perhaps at the end of the pod. But before we do that, it's your first appearance, and so you get the origin story question. What were your first comics, and were they 2000 AD related?
They are semi-2000 AD related. I was introduced to comics as a format in the early 80s by my dad, who was an Eagle magazine buyer back in the 50s. So he kind of got me into it. We found a big pile of his old Eagles up in the loft, and then that got my brain ticking away. And then actually, like a lot of kids from the 80s era, I actually got deeper into comics in a multiple of ways and then into 2000 AD, because my parents, who didn't have a lot of money, would buy me and my brother the Christmas Annual. That brilliant gateway drug into comics. And I remember getting, I think in 1984, the Secret Wars Annual from Marvel, which was mind-blowing. And then I think it was 85 that I still got it somewhere. There's a 2000 AD Annual, and that switched me on to, you know, Dread and Rogue Trooper and the 13th Floor and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not sure my parents knew that they were buying me this very dark, very dystopian, very inappropriate annual for a six-year-old. But after that, I just started going down the shop and buying 2000 AD whenever my pocket money would stretch to it. So there you go.
And interesting, we often hear about Eagle Comics dads getting their particularly sons, obviously, into 2000 AD. Pat Mills was not was on the right lines when he included Dan Dare in the first issue. It's lovely though when you've got a story of your dad buying you comics or introducing you to the comics that he read, which I always love. It's great stuff. Now, important question: do you read 2000 AD and in particular the magazine now?
I do occasionally. Yeah, I'm more of a book collector now. I stopped having to buy it, I don't know, like regularly 10 years ago, because they just pile up. And I'm a bit of a hoarder. I don't like throwing stuff away. So I keep up with it. But actually, my 2000 AD Rebellion book collection is expanding at quite a rate of knots at the moment.
Is it? Right.
Yeah. I'm going to get in trouble with my wife at some point because she needs those shelves back. But yeah, it's growing quite aggressively.
Well, without further ado, let's turn to the book for this episode of the Book Club. Tell us what you've picked to come on and talk about.
I am so excited about this one. So we are going to talk about the 2016 book Realm of the Damned, or the serialized strip that first appeared in Dread Magazine 369 or something like that from 2016. Realm of the Damned.
Realm of the Damned by Alec Worley and Pai Parr, with additional colours in the first volume by Stephen Denton and Luke Preece. I think Pai Parr handles everything else, the design and the lettering himself. In the magazine 369 to 374 in 2016, when I'm going to say the magazine was experimenting a bit more with creator-owned stories than perhaps they've carried on doing. But anyway, we have, I'm guessing, probably got the same trade paperbacks by Werewolf Press.
That's right. Got the trilogy set.
A trilogy set, yes. Now, I think only the first volume gets published in the Judge Dredd magazine, as far as I know.
That's right.
The other two stories were new to me, but obviously I did read this story when it came out in the magazine. So we've got 2016, as you say. We've got Signum Draconis from 2018 and Terra Eternum from 2020. But we're going to focus on the first book, I believe. I don't know if Werewolf Press still exists, actually.
Yeah, I'm not sure, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it was Titan and Heavy Metal in 2016. Then Heavy Metal magazine in 2016, 2000 AD. And then, yeah, I'm not sure about Werewolf Press. I don't know how they fit into the story, actually. I don't know much about them.
No. Okay, not to worry. Well, we'll focus on the book itself and a couple of interesting creators, obviously heavily linked to 2000 AD. Tell us, first of all, why you chose this one for a visit to the book club.
Do you know what? I remember reading it in the magazine, and I don't think I finished it. I think I got, because it was eight... I think it was eight parts, and I probably, because I wasn't buying it regularly at that point, I probably read four. Then I read, then I caught up and read it, you know, in book format. And I just really love a kind of culty horror story. I've got a real soft spot for them. And this one, I just remember looking at the graphics, and I remember looking at the colors, and we'll talk a bit about that later on. And it's just bombastic. Like, it's just ridiculous. I also kind of like comics that get quite a divisive response, especially amongst the 2000 AD fans. And I know this one really split opinion. It was very, very divisive, this one, which also gets me excited about something. So yeah, and it's just, you know, it's gruesome. I love a horror movie. I love a horror comic. It's humorous as well. It's got very kind of Evil Dead beats about it in a kind of silly way. And I just thought, again, Alex's words, the dialogue manages to be really kind of gritty, but it's got that edge of humor and it never comes across as too cheesy. I just think it's a really, really good, solid story.
So we've sort of dealt with where you first encountered it. Tell us, I mean, you've said we're in the realm of horror stories, very much so.
Yeah.
Give us an outline of what Realm of the Damned is about, particularly in this first volume.
Great. Well, I mean, the other thing as well, I think just really quickly, like, I think 2000 AD have also done some really good kind of vampire-inspired material over the years. I was always a really big fan of the Out of the Undercity, the Judge Dredd storyline. And I think this one sort of has a little bit of that as well. So the setup to Realm of the Damned, for anyone that hasn't read it, it leans quite heavily into quite a lot of, into things, story stories and plots that I think people would recognize. Like, it's got a bit of Blade about it, is one of the things that I thought about. So the general synopsis of this one is, like, vampires, werewolves and demons are effectively running the planet. So they're running Earth. The cops and the government and even the church are all basically being, they're powerless against these sort of ghouls and demons. So that in itself is quite a fun kind of flip from your traditional kind of In the Darkness story that these things get come from. The beginning of the first book, a cult called the Brothers of Balair resurrect this old Carpathian legend called Balair, if I'm pronouncing that right. He's this ancient sort of vampiric god figure, and then from there it just kind of descends into total madness. And our protagonist is a guy called Elberic Van Helsing, who's hired by the church that's also run by vampires, or, you know, there's a kind of an old guard of the church. They hire this guy, Elberic Van Helsing, who is the last in the famous monster hunting bloodline, to hunt down and kill our friend Bella before he totally runs amok across the entire planet. And then the first book just kind of goes through, oh yeah, and Balair has to, he's got this job. He has to kill three big other gods amongst people to absorb their power and then become truly immortal. He can walk in the sun and he can do various other things. And it's just a bit of a blast. And I thought the other gods or the other monsters that are in the book are equally as exciting and equally as fun as our friend Balair, the bad guy. What have we got? We've got Queen Nematari, who's the mummified criminal kingpin, who was really good fun. And then Labete, which is the leader of the werewolf clan. And he's got to kill them as well. And then the third...
The Nameless,
that's right. Yeah, and then Athena is the vampire queen, who's sort of an employment of the church and is also his sister.
Yes.
Balesta. So, yeah. So, I mean, apart from some really nice, fun sort of zigs and zags, it's actually a pretty linear story. It's a pretty obvious, straightforward setup. Old god, old guy hired to kill old god, like Bosch. Off you go. It's good fun.
Yeah. And as you say, the old god has got to complete three tasks in order to... become ruler of all, I guess. And you mentioned it was controversial because, as you describe it, you know, you've got this sort of, dare I say, Nordic black metal cult who resurrect Baelor at the start, which makes you feel like, or it makes it start like any Hammer Dracula, where they were always resurrecting him right at the start of the film. But then I think within the first episode, you have this vampire god pissing blood, literally, on his face.
And it's grotesque. I mean, it just starts right out of the gate, doesn't it?
You think, all right, we're not in Hammer Horror here.
Well, it's, I mean, the book is in four parts, and the first part is called Hell's Hunger. And it just goes straight in. It's like, bang, off you go. And they're not just a cult. They're a heavy metal, like, thrash band as well, called the Brothers of Baelor, who, incidentally, I found out during researching of this episode for you, they actually released an album. So they put the band together and released an album to accompany the comic, which I just thought was genius. So somewhere out there is an album by the Brothers of Baelor, which, again, is great fun. But, yeah, that first chapter, the setup is just ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay, so Alec Worley giving us a very dark vampire and other monsters tale. Now, he is obviously known to us, I think, most recently for doing the Hawks the Slayer, but he's written a lot of stuff for 2000 AD and his own books and other comics. Clearly, he's interested in darker and grittier stories, should I say. What do you make of his writing here?
Well, his writing is amazing, and he did Durham Red as well. So he did, you know, he has dipped in out of this.
He rebooted Durham Red, didn't he, into the future?
He did. It's dark, isn't it? This book, it's done in a very Sam Raimi kind of way, and I just think Alec's writing is probably one of the best bits of writing on this particular kind of topic, which is why I really love it, because it's very pulpy. It doesn't take itself too seriously. You know, it's very sweary. And I just, you know, I think he's really kind of self-indulged in the darkness elements of this as well. And I think actually we'll get on to talk about this, I'm sure, but his combination of writing and Simon Parr's like illustrative work on this it just seemed to lock in. Like the two of them were in absolute step. And I think Luke Priest as well on that first book, the three of them just did some astonishing things, but it was Alex's work, really, the writing.
And you've already touched upon it, that we've got this sort of crossover between the world of horror and music.
Yeah.
Now, like I said, I don't know very much about Nordic black metal, but there seems to be a fair bit.
I don't claim to be an expert on Nordic black metal either.
I hadn't put this in our notes because I'd forgotten about it until I reread it last night. We get a literal appearance from the band The Damned in here, don't we?
That's right, yeah. And there's a couple of other bands as well. So there's, what else? I took a note of this one. There's another band called Behemoth, which appear in one of the other books, and then Empire and Mayhem. So they have got nods to some of these other bands.
And, you know, we all know that there's a fair amount of crossover between 2000 AD and heavy metal music, it would seem. Yeah. You know, the fandoms crossover there. I've not yet got to Heavy Metal Dread, which is still in the pool for, or it's back in the pool, rather, for somebody to pick for an upcoming episode. But, I mean, here they are. Melding together metal and comics and having a whale of a time doing it. And it is, as you say, it's dark, it's gritty, and, explosive in places, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's some crazy stuff. Like, you know, I wish the listeners could see it. I got the book in front of me, and there were, like, one stuff explodes in this book. Like, it explodes. Like, it's all jacked up to 20 on absolutely everything. It doesn't hold back, and it goes quite quickly as well, it clips. But that's one of the things I thought. In that sense, I thought I think this could live in the Dread universe.
Right.
And I don't know whether that was kind of, you know, it obviously doesn't, but, you know, Alec and Pi and Luke and these people, they're all from that stable. Like, they've all done enough work with 2000 AD at this point. And you just feel like, okay, this could actually just be part of that world. You expect Dread to walk out at any point and, you know, take part in this story. So, yeah, everything is over the top. Everything is absolutely ridiculous. The machines, the gadgets, are all very much kind of very, very over the top. And in that sense, I just thought, like, brilliant, what a load of fun. Horror should be like that.
And he deals with the horror archetypes, you know, the vampire, the Frankensteinian creature, the werewolves, the mummy, and, of course, Van Helsing. How well do you think Alec Worley does with all of those
brilliant
characters? Yeah,
brilliant. And I really, really good. And I love it. So my particular favourite, the thing that I really enjoyed when I first read this was they've got a really nice twist on Van Helsing. Like, he's not your classic sort of Hammer horror Van Helsing as you'd expect. He's actually an addict. So they flipped the kind of vampire trope. There's obviously a lot written over the years about the fact that, you know, vampirism is a kind of metaphor for addiction. Well, they've actually flipped it in this book so that Van Helsing is the addict and he's addicted to vampire blood. So he's got, that's like the drug that gets, you know, people sort of absolutely off their pickle. And Van Helsing is an addict to that. And that's actually how Athena, the queen of the vampires, lures him in to be like the killer. So, you know, you're going to go and kill my brother. We can't do it because he's already, you know, bested us several times. You're going to do it. So I thought the Van Helsing flip was really, really interesting in this. And he's a wizened old man. He uses, there's no stakes in this one, as far as I can remember. There are no, like, you know, holy water and crosses. It's all Uzis and hand grenades and like light bombs and stuff. It's a bit more Blade in that sense, but really good. And I really like the way that they've kind of, you know, the werewolves, I didn't think were too, they're recognizably werewolves, but they're huge. Like, they're massive, great big beasties. They were really cool. And I think they really did every one of those kind of popular characters a really nice twist, so it wasn't too familiar.
Now, Alec Worley is very well versed in the world of horror. I'm sure there's lots of references in here I didn't get. The one I got last night, again, was that when we switched to the werewolf section, he sets it in Lozère, France, where there is a local, you know, a real life local legend of the beast of this particular area. I guess it's another variant on the fame, you know, the infamous black dogs that are
nice
in various parts of the world. But yeah, there is a real sort of genuine sort of werewolf legend in that part of France. Nice. I don't know if you follow Alec on Substack. He writes about horror extremely well. His essay, I think, last week about Hannibal Lecter and, you know, how he's treated in the Thomas Harris novels is really good.
Nice.
Yeah, it is. He's very good on horror.
Not follow him, but I'm going to now, because that sounds like a great place to indulge myself and Alex sort of with the writing, because
he's
good, isn't he?
Yeah. Now, I know that we were expecting, I think I'm right in saying, Simon Pye Parr at Enniskillen this year. And you were particularly excited to meet him, but sadly he couldn't make it.
Yeah.
Were you partly excited to meet him because of this book?
Well, I mean, I was carrying around the box set in my bag. We did take it all the way to Northern Ireland. Do you know what? I really wanted to have a conversation with him. I've met him before. Several times around, you know, when he was doing Petrolhead and stuff like that. And he's a super guy. He's a really, really, really lovely man. And I had totally forgot, actually, that I had Realm of the Damned on the shelf. And I thought, oh, he's going to be in Enniskillen and we're going to get plenty of time to talk to all these characters and these people. So I'm going to take this one. I'm going to have a really good chinwag with him about Realm of the Damned. It's not a slim trilogy, this one. It's three quite good-sized books. And he wasn't there.
Yeah, sadly.
So he still owes me some signatures on these, but I do want to just touch base with him.
Pi, if you're listening, you owe Pete.
Yeah, you owe me this one. I'll tell you what, just really quickly, the other thing I was really excited to talk to him about, actually, is in 2017, the other thing, if people listening to this want to go and hunt it down, and I was going to chat to Pi about this, they actually turned this into an audiobook and a motion comic. Now, the motion comic is actually sensational, and the style of the book is actually really, really good, and it was turned into an animated audio drama by BBC Studios that had a really, really good voice cast as well. David Vincent as Elberic Van Helsing. Again, sort of kept up with all of the over-the-top violence and black metal aesthetic. They put the music and everything to it, so it just kind of came to life. And I don't think there's many artists out there that cross into so many media types as Simon, because he comes from a graphic design background and he's clearly got a very different eye in a lot of ways than some of the other artists that we kind of hang out with and have conversations with. So that's what I was really excited about having a conversation with him about, is the other media that surround this particular book.
I think I'd vaguely heard of the motion comic. I had no idea it'd been adapted for audio as well.
Yeah.
I just have to track these down and put some links in the show notes for this episode.
Yeah, I think that's where a lot of its cult following came from, because, you know, you can find bits of it on YouTube and things like that. There were lots of, and it's really, I'm going to say this, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, it's absolutely not, but some of it is, like, the motion and everything is quite, almost South Park-y. Like, there's a bit of, you know you're looking at a motion comic.
Right.
It's not, you know, slick animation or anything like that, but it just kind of works. It's a brilliant, brilliant adaptation.
Now, I know Piper, I think, most for his graphic design work, which you've mentioned. I think the current 2000 AD and magazine logos, both designed by himself. Intestinauts still comes back from time to time in the prog. And then, of course, as you've mentioned, Petrolhead with Rob Williams. Those two, much more bright and colourful tone than Realm of the Damned.
Well, it depends. I mean, the colour work in the first book especially, I think, is absolutely incredible.
Yes. Well, I mean, yes. Then the colour is, a lot of it is going to be reds, obviously, because it's quite a bloody comic. So he's done the whole package. He's done the design. He's done all the logos, I'm guessing. He's done the lettering. Tell us about his artwork on Realm of the Damned.
Well, the artwork is for me, is absolutely, you know, off the planet. It's brilliant. The other thing about this book, as I was hunting around, is, and I've got a great quote from Simon, actually, that I found. But this was his first proper book. So this was first proper series. So this is the time. So the quote that I found was, he basically was quoted as saying, on his blog, actually, it's the... This is the three-book project that allowed me to become a full-time freelance artist. So even though I'm glad it's finally done, it does seem, it does mean a huge amount to me. And this book is really mental, featuring cults, werewolves, vampires, fish mutants, and a colossal fleshy spider monster that looks like it's made from a ball bag skin. That was Simon's description. And then he goes on to talk about the fact that he was allowed to kind of indulge in the gruesome killings and... the ultra-violent, sweary, blasphemous, black metal-inspired supernatural horror that he grew up admiring, just like he admired Alec Worley. So I actually think this book probably means a huge amount to him as a human being as well, because it was like his first foray into full comic booking before he got to Intestinauts and Petrolhead and all the stuff that he's been doing so brilliantly since. His artwork in this, though, is phenomenal, and it is digital art.
Right.
Right, so... You know, it's a graphic, and you can tell that as well. It's very slick. It's got, you know, it's very clean. It's very computer graphic design, but not in a bad way. Like, this is clearly a kind of, you know, tablet stylus and drawn straight into machine kind of deal right here. But that's what he does. He's from a graphic design background, so. Yeah, love it. Absolutely brilliant. Just one other thing I want to say about the color work is, you've already said it, like black and red are the two, and gray are the two like prominent colors throughout this. But when they put other colors in, those other colors really jump. So there are lovely bits. There are just the odd panel every now and again where an explosion might be blue, or there might be a little flick of electric blue somewhere. And in a comic where everything else is, you know, black, grey, white, and red, when those other colours come in, they come in really, really well. It's a very, very clever thing to do. And it reminded me quite a lot of the work that Henry Flint had done on Chikara.
Oh, right. Okay.
Well, that's again, another one. Yeah. You know, you take stark colours... You know, and then when you flash in other colors, suddenly those other colors become so much more important to the storyline. So, yeah, very clever. Very, very clever artwork.
Yeah, the electric blue moments when they come in, or rather the blue sort of electricity, they sort of really pop off the page, don't they? The yeah. Nameless's heart and the sort of blue effect that Baylor can sort of breathe.
Yeah.
Really, when you, as you say, you've got blacks, whites, greys, a lot of red, and then suddenly you get this other colour and it just sort of literally yeah. explodes off the page, which is fascinating.
Yeah, and anytime there's a computer screen, it's like green, so there's always a kind of fleck of green in the background. And right. then, you know, I've forgotten her name already, the Egyptian-inspired...
Nemitari.
Candles, Nemitari, yeah. you know, her face and her shoulder pads are yellow.
Right.
So anytime you get to the kind of the bits where she pops up, there's suddenly these kind of really bold, you know, yellow colours in a very grey world. And it just makes those characters almost more exciting. So, yeah, I love the colour work in this. And I love the stuff that, you know, that Simon's done in terms of the style of the way that everything is drawn and the red eyes. Yes, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
And I'm glad you pointed that out to me, because obviously... I mean, I could say that it's maybe his superb skills as a graphic designer, but when he does introduce the new characters and the colour palette shifts slightly, that's yeah. great. I see that I keep looking at the band The Damned, who are picked out in green light and when they're playing, they're gigging. Yeah. No, I was going to say the colouring is superb. And also the character design is just wonderful throughout.
Yeah. There's a really nice moment, sort of maybe it's after Baylor's like defeated Nemitari, and without ruining it, spoiler alert, you know, suddenly can walk in the sun. Then there are some really colourful pages. So you go, you know, with the sunrise and things like that, really quite wonderful, because you go from black and white into these like quite big coloured pages and then back into black and white. But yeah, every time they do that, I just feel like it adds a little bit something to the story. So really clever. Very, very clever indeed.
Any favourite character design within the book or particular characters?
Absolutely. The werewolves I just thought were phenomenal. Yeah, there were a couple of pages in the second chapter is called, the second part. Let's see, make sure I get it right. Yeah, the second part is called Werewolves of the Storm. Wolves Against the Storm, sorry. And half of it is kind of the exposition around the background to Baylor and where he came from and how he was defeated back in the Dark Ages. And then there's this big introduction to the wolves. And I just thought they were great, because again, there was a little bit underworld about them. So there's a little bit of a kind of nod to those movies, but they're just big, French, like,
yeah.
just bombastic, absolutely massive. They don't muck around. They're not like... you know, the kind of werewolves that we think about. They're 3-4 times as big. They're like WWE wrestlers.
Yeah.
They're huge and they're really good fun. And some of them are totally over the top, overpowered. And some of them are just, you know, really easy to defeat. But they were just great. They had really great characteristics to them. And yeah, those were definitely some of my favorites.
Right.
Those big yellow eyes as well on the gray pages. Just, again, another great touch by Simon.
Now, there's a nameless character I really liked, which is obviously a nod to Frankenstein's creature, but I don't think they're allowed to say that. Although, actually, no, that's in public domain, isn't it? But anyway,
yeah.
I like the design of the nameless creature. Everybody gets a go at designing a Frankenstein monster at some point, I guess. And
yeah.
I like Simon's version.
Yeah, they were really... And there was some... really, really good. And actually, I think... The great thing about all of the character design, especially the kind of the monsters and the ghoulies, they're all familiar, but they're all different from, you know, how we would ordinarily think about them. So, yeah, really, really great. Love them.
What about Mr. Van Helsing himself? He has a face that's seen a lot of stuff, hasn't he?
He has, yeah. There's a couple of... Again, he gets put through the mincer in this book as well. He doesn't have an easy life, bless him.
No.
But yeah, Van Helsing I thought was a great character. Very very cynical, very broken, very kind of beaten up. He's a junkie. He's an old drug addict. And there's he gets locked in a coffin and buried. He gets shot at and stabbed and bitten and all kinds of stuff. He gets put in some kind of ancient mask that gives you nightmares. Yes, he doesn't have a good time of it, but throughout the whole thing, he seems absolutely obsessed with just getting his next fix. So he's just, you know, he's chasing the dragon for the entire book, which, again, I just thought was kind of fun. He seems like a character that doesn't have a huge amount to live for.
No.
And sometimes those are often the best ones, aren't they? Because they can, he's not scared of anything. But yeah, really good character, actually. Really great. How old do you reckon he is?
He's supposed to be a couple of hundred years old, isn't he, at least?
Right.
I think. And because he's extended his life by injecting vampire blood, hasn't he?
Right.
There's a wonderful splash full page of him that we might come back to a bit later on in the pod. I'm reminded of somebody, of course, who was at Enniskillen this year, that Garth Ennis was there. He does look... Garth Ennis always refers to these characters like John Wagner and Steve Dillon, sort of like, what did he call them, hard bastards or something like that, you know?
Yeah, that's a good shout. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I like that very much. There's a great bit just towards the end, and again, I apologise to anybody that's not read it if we're doing spoilers here, but where he puts on Balar's old armour.
Yeah.
And then he suddenly goes from being this kind of like, you know, sort of old street urchin sort of vampire killer to a knight. It's a great touch, but he's got a big Tommy gun. Like, he's got just really, really good fun. But I can definitely see what Garth is talking about there. That is that's a good shout. Although he does look a little bit like Garth Ennis, actually. So,
oh, well, there you go. Now, you said this is all digital. So I suppose the next question about whether you own any of Simon's art is a tricky one, because does he work entirely digitally, I guess?
Yeah, well, I mean, the only piece of Simon's art that we own as a family, I don't own any. I wish I did. And actually, there's bits of his that I would love to get hold of at some point. Like, you know, there's a cover to the ABC Warriors solo missions book for Rebellion, which is Simon, and it's just magnificent. It's brilliant.
Is that the motorcycle one?
Yes, exactly. Brilliant. And various other bits and bobs, but it's all digital. However, my 12-year-old daughter and I met him last year at the Olympia Winter Comic Con, and they were out publicizing Petrolhead, and Simon was really, really kind, actually, because he'd met Phoebe before at Lawless in May, and then we saw him again in winter, and he said, you know, come back in half an hour. And when we came back, he'd hand sketched this really wonderful Petrolhead page for her.
Nice.
With the bird on the shoulder. She has it up next to her bed, and it was and so we do have a piece of Simon's original kind of hand drawn in the house, but it's not anything from the books, and unfortunately it's not mine, it's hers. So but well, I mean, look, he's leaning into the latest and greatest way of doing these things, but it does, I guess it does mean that these pictures are not available to buy, and I'd love to own some of these because there's some great pages in there.
It will make the Grail page game slightly harder, anyway, we'll get to that in a moment. The other two volumes that come after this that make up a slipcase trilogy, you know, we decided to focus on the first volume, but tell us a little bit about the other two volumes quickly.
Right. So, I mean, I really love all three. I think they're great books. The first one for me is standout though, because I remember seeing it. I remember, you know, reading it going, I haven't seen anything like this for a long time, if at all. The second book, Signum Draconis, is again, it's got Athena, Balar's sister is back. She's defending the ancestral stronghold against Baylor's influence. She's dragging Van Helsing further into a tangled war of gods, monsters, and blood depths. Like, so again, it's a little bit more of the same, but different. The third book, actually, I thought was getting close to as good as the first book. The third book is probably my second favorite. So book one, book three, and then book two in that order. So Terra Aeternum, these kind of witch cults and vampire forces are battling against each other. But the third book has got this insane 20-ish page car chase at the beginning. It's crazy. It's like Fast and Furious or something like that. The antagonist in that particular part, the protagonist, sorry, is being chased by a pack of werewolves. It's just ridiculous. Like, the first 20 pages of the third book, absolutely joyful. Same style, same kind of, you know, the same kind of bombastic colors and gore and swear and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, really, really good. It does seem like the three books flow through each other really nicely as well. So, yeah, just, I mean, the colours are slightly different in the third book. There's a lot more kind of greens because there's some different kind of cults and things like that, that kind of more forest cults that dive into some of the green colours. And there's also some, in the third book, there's also some really nice kind of vertical double page spreads as well, which, you know, I love it when people do that with comics where they kind of make you have to twist the book around. Turn the book around. So, yeah, and I think, you know, again, I'm trying not to ruin the plot too much of the other two because I think they're a sort of same, but slightly different. But I think the third book, and there's also this is phenomenal double page spread in the third book as well, right bang in the middle. The Church of the Scream Perpetual, and it's this giant kind of, it's really difficult to describe, like church on the back of a giant sort of reanimated robot. It's mad. And I think they probably just pulled out all the stops because they knew they were going to do a trilogy. So book one for its originality is my favorite, absolute favorite. Book two is great. It continues. But book three, I think, is a close second. It's a lot of fun, book three. It's a lot more blood in it as well.
It's also got the spider creature that looks like a ball bag. And yep, it's got, that's the one. As you said, you mentioned Fast and Furious. I thought very Mad Max Fury Road, but with werewolves, you know.
Yeah, great shout. Yeah definitely. The rock bands are back. So we have a lot more of the rock bands. But yeah, I think all three stand up. But I think book one is a classic.
Now, there are spin-offs, as you've said. You've mentioned that there's music, there's motion comic, there's an audio book, maybe.
Yeah.
When there is. There is a... In the back of the third one, it's got a DVD version of the motion comic and also a puzzle. It's a jigsaw puzzle, it says. I don't know if that's still available.
There you go. Not sure I'm ready to do a Realm of the Damned jigsaw puzzle, but...
It might not be one to take to the holiday cottage with the family.
Definitely not. Yeah. But yeah, the third book's got the sketches in the back as well, which again, I love it when they do that. Oh, no, actually the second book has as well. So they've got the... sketch art and stuff in there, so
there is some back matter in these books, which is always nice to have. Yeah, great stuff. You mentioned obviously your first one's the favorite, third one after that. You particularly like the werewolf character design, although, you know, each of these different archetypes is fantastic. Any other particular favorite moments that you can mention from the first book?
Yeah, well, do you know what, I think right from the very beginning of the first book I was sucked right in. I think the transformation scene, the very, very first chapter, I just think was absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Because again, I apologize for anybody listening that's not read it. I'm going to spoil it. But back when Baelor was defeated, Athena basically knocked his jaw off with a big mace. So she's like, you know, in the second part, you get the exposition and she's knocked off his jaw with a mace. And then somehow the brothers of Baelor have found this old mask that's made from Baelor's jaw. And it's this grotesque kind of looking thing, which they actually put on some of the advertising for the magazine, right? So there's this picture of the mask. Now, in order to resurrect him, you have to burn somebody alive inside a church or something like that. And there's this poor dude called Christopher who owes the brothers money or something, and they force this mask on his face, and then Baelor basically explodes out of him and comes back from the dead. And I just thought that entire first chapter was ridiculously good fun. The first thing Baelor does is piss blood, and you know, he's covered in blood and he's exploded out of this poor guy Christopher's body and the mask. And I just thought, you know what, this is going to be a whole ton of ridiculous bombastic nonsense, and I'm all in on it. So the first chapter is absolutely standout.
I do remember that being a moment that divided the 2000 AD forums when this came
absolutely
out.
Yeah. Absolutely. I've got to read this quote because I when I saw it from the, because I went digging through the forums when we were researching for this one, somebody who will remain nameless literally posted on the 2000 AD forum, "Realm of the Damned has got to be the most unpleasant strip ever published by Tharg. It took the magazine in a direction I'd really prefer it would avoid in the future." I'm like, well, great. I love it even more now because it's really upset some of the traditional kind of the 2000 AD purists. Brilliant.
I don't know. I mean, you know, we've both been at Lawless. We know that, as I say, there's quite a crossover between heavy metal and 2000 AD. But yeah, okay. Well, there you go. Perhaps that's why the second and third books were published independently by Werewolf Press.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's a good point, actually. They didn't want 2000 AD, didn't want to follow up on them. They didn't want them back for the other two books.
I don't think the other two were in the magazine, were they? Yeah, I don't think so. Weren't. Yeah, interesting. But yeah, maybe Alec Worley and Simon just thought they could do their own. They could do their own thing with Werewolf Press.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry to interrupt you. The other reason I remember when it first came out in the magazine, it had that great Judge Dredd story From the Ashes by Michael Carroll and Carlos, and great letters by Annie as well. So I remember that magazine brilliantly because From the Ashes was such a good storyline, and then you flick through a little bit and then suddenly you've got Baylor exploding from some guy's body and you go like, right, well done 2000 AD, this is exactly what you were designed to do.
Yeah,
take us on a really bizarre path.
So it is, the three-volume box set is still available on Amazon for about £14. It's all on Kindle Comixology digitally. I've got the hard copy. I'm guessing you carried the hard copies already. Yeah, Skinning. So, yes. But it is available, quite easy to get hold of, and it is certainly worth a look, particularly if you like darker, gruesome, gory horror stories. I don't know if Damien, who was on a few weeks ago talking about 28 Days Later, has read this one. I might have to give him my copy. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a really good stock of, artists and writers that do horror that have gone through 2000 AD, like, you know, Charlie Adam went off and did Walking Dead and all that kind of stuff.
Made his fortune with The Walking Dead.
Exactly. So it's not like there haven't been enough horror stories throughout 2000 AD's history. I just don't think there's been one quite like this.
Yeah, it's slightly more gruesome than Fiends of the Eastern Front.
It is. Although, you know, Fiends has its moments as well, but that's pure black and white. Maybe if this was in just black and white, it wouldn't be quite so gruesome, but it is the colour.
It is the sudden explosions of blood.
Yeah, a lot of it as well.
Yeah. So. Baylor with his, when he's exploded, but he still hasn't got his jaw on yet. And
brilliant.
Which, of course, is the cover of the first volume.
Yeah.
Okay, so Grail pages are tricky because, as we say, it is digital. But imagine it all existed in some format, or that Simon could do you an exclusive one-off high-quality print that he would sign for you.
Yeah.
Pick a page or two or a cover or to hang in the virtual art gallery of the book club.
Brilliant. I'm going to be naughty. I've actually got an outlier. So I've got three, actually. But okay. The other thing I found as I was digging around, I'll just show it to you on the camera. The magazine cover.
Yes.
From 374.
So that was the last issue it appeared in, wasn't it?
Yeah, with Baylor, just him glaring, like growling into the cover, I just thought was magnificent. So, I mean, notable mention to that. My absolute favourite, if I could get my hands on a page tomorrow, there are two really, and then I've got a notable third mention that I'm going to show it. Annoyingly, there are no page numbers.
No, I know.
Which, again, it's really difficult to go like page 33, but
yeah.
There's that great picture of Albert Van Helsing, and it's right near the end of the book, and the sun is kind of behind him, and it's this stark blue background with him looking really kind of broken, disheveled. There is, you know, specks of blood on him. It's this really, really lovely page. So there's a big close-up full page of him, which I really, really, really love, and I'd love to own that page if it did ever come up in a print. And then I think the other one, which is a bit of it's a bit obvious actually, because it was overused probably during the promotion of the book, but Baylor on the Throne.
Yes.
It's a cracking page. And it's basically a picture of our protagonist. He's sitting on a throne. And, I mean, we've all seen pictures in popular culture of, you know, the horror hero sitting on a throne of skulls and bones and things like that. But this is a combination of skulls, bones, and actual heads. So it's just, it's crazy. It's wacky. And he's got this like weird grin and his mouth is completely covered in blood. Yeah, brilliant. And there's like, again, without getting too kind of gory about it, but it is a very gory book. He's got like blood on his knuckles. So this is a guy who doesn't just bite them in the neck or something, like he beat you as well. So yeah, really, really love that one. And then my third pick, actually, the other one that I chose, because I thought it was the most Pi page in the book, because of some of the stuff, because Pi does, Simon does machines really, really well. Like the ABC Warriors stuff that he did was amazing. Petrolhead is clearly like right in a special place for him in terms of kind of bringing machinery to life. He's ripe for a Transformers episode at some point, isn't he? Mm. But there's that great page of...
Yep.
There's a great page kind of maybe three quarters of the way through the book. And you get in the bottom half of the page, you get Nemitari's like mask, because the bright yellow. And then behind it is a schematic of her robotic body drawn on kind of papyrus parchment. And again, there's great colors in there. It's done incredibly well, but it's kind of robotic. It's quite machine based. And it's actually very classic Simon Parr, I think, that one. And it's a wonderful page as well. So I picked those three.
Fantastic. Well, I will post those on the social media when this episode comes out so people can see what we're talking about. I thought we might be mentioning the penultimate page of chapter three, which is the close-up on Van Helsing's face.
Yeah.
Marvellous. Baylor on the throne doing the villain sprawl, yeah, on the throne. And then Nemitari's sort of blueprint or... I don't know, what would you call it in papyrus? Papyrus.
I have no idea.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the other thing I just have to say, like, I picked three pages that are full page spreads, it was difficult to find pages because actually the panel pages, the layouts in some of the pages are magnificent. Like, the way that the panels flow are really, really good. And some of the panels, you don't really get more than about five or six panels per page. It's usually four, and they're really, really good panels as well. But I think those pages just stood out to me.
And sometimes with the Grail pages, we have pages where we'd like to own them, but not necessarily hang them and display them.
Yeah, I'm not sure my wife will want any of those.
Okay. Okay, so maybe there will be ones for the portfolio or for the man cave. So. Yeah.
I think so.
I'm going to, because I thought you might pick Van Helsing, I'm going to go very nice and easy just because I've got a thing about owls and just choose the very first page because nice. It's got a great Simon Parr owl on it. It does unfortunately have the lettering that's got a C word on it. So again, it's probably one for the portfolio.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does.
But yeah, the owl I just thought was magnificent.
Those green and red eyes, and orange eyes.
Fantastic. Yeah, so I really enjoyed it. We've done a couple of dark books on the podcast recently that I've struggled with, but this one I actually had a lot of fun with because it is such a fun romp.
Yeah, it is.
So thanks for picking it. Did you have anything else in your notes that you wanted to bring up about the first volume or the other two at all, Pete?
I don't think so. I would just urge anybody that's not read it just to try and get a copy because it is a load of fun, that book. It's really rude though, isn't it? There's a lot of nakedness in them as well, which again, I know is not very sort of trendy at the moment, but yeah, it's a throwback. It's almost like a very 80s, it's like an 80s horror movie.
Right.
In a lot of ways. So I just think everybody should go and have a look at this one.
If Fiends of the Eastern Front had been made by Sam Raimi.
Yeah, exactly.
With production design by Simon Parr. Fantastic stuff. So like I say, it is readily available. Get hold of copies while there's still hard copies around, I guess, because I don't think Werewolf Press is still going, but there are. Right. It does seem to be easy to get hold of at the moment, and it is available digitally. And I'll post those Grail pages that we've been talking about when the episode comes out. As you say, sadly, most of his work is digitally, but your daughter does have at least a sketch of Petrolhead. And I've forgotten what the bird's name is, but the little bird, yeah.
Yeah. Although, you know, we've already mentioned it. The back of the books, there are Simon's original sketches. So he will, somewhere in existence, are sketches from, like, original sketchbooks that inspired the three stories. So there must be some some hand-drawn pages around somewhere.
Must be, yeah. Okay, well, hopefully the next time you see him, you'll be able to ask him.
Well, there you go, if he turns up.
Have conversations with him. Well, let's do guest projects and take a quick trip back to Enniskillen in Northern Ireland, because you'd made the journey over to meet your friend Giles, and we had a splendid weekend. You were carting around some stuff to be signed. Who did you meet that you were sort of very pleased to encounter?
Oh, wow. I mean, firstly, what a great conference. Like, it's a really, really wonderful experience. Like, it was my birthday weekend, and Giles said, look, let's go to Enniskillen. We'd done Lawless together and various other things. So we went over there, did the road trip across from Belfast. And, you actually get up and close to everybody who's in attendance. Like, I just spent a really good sort of solid 15, 20 minutes chatting to Will Simpson in that great room off to the side with all of his artwork.
Yeah.
And I'd taken some stuff for him to sign, and then you walk into that room that they set him up with, and the actual original kind of watercolors from the pages in the books I was trying to get signed were up on the walls, and you just kind of, and he was an absolute delight. I've not met Will before. Who else did I have a really good conversation with? Dan McDade. I always pronounce his name wrong, but I think it's McDade. Again, I was really chuffed to meet him. He did a really phenomenal piece, a book called Neil Before Zod, a Superman spin-off about General Zod. And he sold me one of the pages, his original drawings from that, which I was absolutely over the moon about because it was my favorite page in the book and he still had it. So I was really happy to meet him. Kieran McEwen, I really, really enjoyed spending time with Kieran. He was really great. And Michael Carroll as well. Like, I've met him before multiple times, but he was in a really happy mood walking around. He wasn't even behind a table. He was just kind of hanging out with us and walking around and chatting to everybody. And yeah, I would definitely recommend Enniskillen. I just think it's a really nice, nice, nice weekend.
Yeah, it's astonishing. Talked about it with Giles. Yeah, what a great weekend. What a great convention Paul Trimble and his team put on.
Yeah.
Now, Dan Cornwall was, of course, at Lawless and at Enniskillen this year. And one of the recurrent jokes was how many people went back to his table to look at a certain piece of original artwork.
Yeah.
All of us wondering whether we could pull the trigger and actually buy it.
Yeah.
I'm going to sort of give it away if I'm allowed to talk about this, because you were the person who did buy this piece of artwork in the end.
Yeah, not in Northern Ireland either.
No. So tell us, what happened? How did you come to buy it, and what is it?
There was a joke at Lawless in May. So Dan, in his book of pieces for sale, had the original hand-drawn A3 page for the Spectre trade paperback.
That marvellous cover.
It's absolutely astonishing. Like, it's so detailed. It's so intricate. So the Spectre book came out last year, I think. It had this magnificent cover on it. I don't know if any, but I mean, people who know it know it. So he was at Lawless, and the joke was, he was trying to sell it to me at Lawless, and I won't talk about the numbers, but the joke was that John Wagner was also really interested in owning it. So me and John had kind of been having some banter about who was going to pick this thing up off Dan, and then Dan was involved in the joke as well. So, and then when we were back in Enniskillen, it's a lot more intimate than, some of the other conferences. Lawless is very intimate, but, everybody kind of gets to hang out and you get a little bit more time to chat. And it was there on the table and he still hadn't sold it. And I said to him, look, I'll tell you what, I'm going to take it off you. But instead of taking it off him in Enniskillen, I actually went down to his studio in East Sussex and picked it up a couple of weeks later.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I did a little road trip from London down to his studio, and me and Dan kind of had a cup of tea and hung out, and I took the Spectre page home, which I now own and is hanging very proudly on the wall in one of my rooms in the house. And it's my favorite thing at the moment. It's brilliant.
It is such a wonderful page, or rather cover. It's the one where the sort of the city has become the face of the character Spectre. Such a marvellous piece of design and art. And as you say, in black and white, even seems even more intricate than it does appear on the cover.
It does.
it's astonishing. Several of us went back to it several times over the two weekends.
Yeah.
So I'm glad it went to a very good home.
Yeah. It's gone to a really good home. And every time I walk past it, and it's one of those great pages where you every time you walk past, you stop and you look at it, like as a good piece of art should do.
Yeah.
And I always spot something different in it as well.
Oh, nice.
There's always there are all these little hidden Easter eggs, and, you know, like his name is on the side of one of the vans that are driving along the bridge at the front, and just like little things like that. So, yeah, really nice. So, yeah, so I own the Spectre cover, the original sketch for that, which I'm very happy about.
Congratulations. It is a piece of artwork that you can display on a wall rather than have to hide in the portfolio. And it is a marvellous piece. I'm glad you've got it. So well done.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Pete, I'm going to ask you about your own books. You've written two so far. The first one's called Hippo, the human-focused digital book. The second one is about the band, and I realise I've never heard this word pronounced. Is it Electrassy or...?
Electrassy.
Electrassy is the name of the band, Calling All the Dreamers.
Yeah.
But you're particularly interested in the book that you're working on at the moment, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, I've got a really fun project bubbling away. So the first book I wrote a long time ago now was a bit more of a work-focused book. I work in technology and AI, and it was about... This was 2015 and 16. It was about the kind of potential impact on humanity of AI and emerging technology and people's behavior, especially. And then a couple of years later, I actually ended up doing a book with an old Britpop band from the 90s called Electrassy, who are from my hometown. The book is called Calling All the Dreamers. But that was really about the impact of technology on their career and the careers of many musicians over the years, from piracy to, you know, replication of music and things like that. So there's a thread that runs through those two books, same, but different. And then actually when I was in Enniskillen in June, I got chatting to a couple of the artists and writers in the pub on the Saturday evening. And we got into some quite interesting conversations about the impact of AI on the comic industry. So writing and illustration and stuff like that. A little spark went off in my head, and I thought, do you know what? I think I've got my third book here, so I can write something about this from the point of view of the technology and the technologist. And I'm starting to get some input from various other people. So we're in the process of writing a book, should be out next year. It's called Drawn to Extinction. And yeah, and so I've had some really great conversations already with people like Ram V. I'm hassling people like Patrick Goddard to, you know, pull his finger out and come for his interview, and Dan Cornwall, it's getting a really interesting traction now. So the more the writers and the artists find out that this is happening, the more of them are coming forward, and then we're just putting it all together into a really interesting kind of expose on what's happening to the industry, the potential impact of AI on replicating original art, and what happens to the artists when their work is effectively ingested, you know, by machines and then replicated. So that's a really exciting project, and we should have it out next year. And it crosses a few of my streams, which is something we all want to try and do at some point.
Very nice. I'm looking forward to it. That sounds definitely up my street. And I will link to your website in the show notes for this episode so people can keep an eye out for when that's coming up. Social media links, are you, because I know you mentioned this on Blue Sky. Is Blue Sky the one you're on?
Yeah, I try and stay on that. I've been trying to stay off the other socials. They're all a bit toxic at the moment. So,
very sensible.
Yeah, you can find me on Blue Sky. PeteTrainer.fyi, I think, is the name on it. I'm on there.
Great stuff. Pete, well, I'm looking forward to your book next year, which I will be getting, and I'm certainly enjoyed going through Realm of the Damned.
Yeah, it's
and
great.
Having a great horror romp, and particularly doing Mad Max Fury Road with werewolves, I think.
So much better than my Fast and Furious analogy.
Well, that's, you know, both. I don't know. I mean, George Miller, we should ring up, maybe. But
yeah. He could make this book.
Like, he could.
He's the perfect guy to bring this to the screen.
Yeah. Pete, it's been great. Thank you very much for choosing it. We had a fantastic time together in Enniskillen, so thank you for that. And thank you for being on the book club.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a blast.
No problem at all. And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. Find all the links at megacitybookclub.com. You can find us on Blue Sky as well by searching for Mega City Book Club, where you will see the Grail pages that we've been talking about, including the magazine cover that also got an honourable mention. And if you want to come on the book club, email me mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. And that will do us. Until next time, when we're passing judgment on another great book, it's goodbye from me and...
Goodbye from me. Thank you.